You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 12, The Patagonian Revolution Part 2, The Second Conquest of the Desert. Today I'm recording from the Bella Vista Ranch. During the events of 1921 and 1922 in Patagonia, what occurred to the workers was very explicitly compared to the fates that had befallen the Indians. Here's what the right-wing newspaper El Soldado Argentino said. Like the Indian before him, the pariah, without family, home, religion, or fatherland, becomes a murderer and a vandal, burning crops and attacking ranches. The moderate liberal newspaper wrote, the same was done to the Indians in that bloodbath they called the conquest of the desert. There was 9 months of relative peace before things blew up again. If we'll recall, the workers won what's now considered the first wave of strikes. That's how the union and the business leaders saw it. In the process, though, two policemen and many workers were killed. Many buildings were burned down, and fences all over Patagonia were cut. I didn't mention, but this was the most relevant version of monkey wrenching for ranches, right? Letting the livestock escape. What's more, Colonel Varela appears to have achieved his goal, peace without bloodshed. This is the part of the movie or TV show that I always do where I'm like, okay, if we turn off the show now, everything is good. But this is history, so we must continue. There's an exchange recorded between one of the leaders of the Rural Society. The Rural Society represented ranchers, if you'll remember, who said to Colonel Varela, when you leave, it will all start again. Colonel Varela replied, if it starts up again, I'll come back and shoot the lot. So the problem was, things as they stood now were only satisfactory to the workers, and many of the shopkeepers and petite bourgeoisie. Or, you know, in other words, the people who do the work, right? Things were not satisfactory to the bosses, or to foreign capital, or to the police and military. The Santa Cruz wing of the Argentine Patriotic League tripled down on attacking the workers' movement. They said that the goals of liberty, fraternity, and equality, those are foreign notions, spread by foreign agitators. Ironically, not a single member of the Rio Gallegos chapter of the Patriotic League was Argentine-born. Meanwhile, as you might expect, Antonio Soto and the Rio Gallegos Workers' Society, this strike popped off on March 25, 1921. They were defeated after only a week through the combination of the workers being too precarious to stay on strike and internal opposition within FORA, which, as you'll recall, is the more anarchist union that the Rio Gallegos Workers' Society was a part of. To make a long story short, trade unions were breaking away from FORA because bosses were willing to cut better deals with them in order to undermine the great big union. Now, good skilled workers versus troublemaking unskilled workers. That is, you know, textbook. That's just what happened in the United States, and I'm sure it happened in many other countries. The new, more reactionary quasi-union was called the Free Labor Association, and it was filled with skilled tradesmen. We'll talk about the Free Labor Association later. In the meantime, Governor Correa Falcon, now no longer governor, he began to arm the upper and middle classes, pushing the Patriotic League and the Free Labor Association. He was preparing them to help the bosses renege on their agreements with workers. Judge Vinas picked a really bad time to go to Buenos Aires on vacation. The workers really needed him. But his trip, an extended stay in Buenos Aires, was probably not an accident. Antonio Soto and his union were working on a boycott system to ensure that all of their contracts would be upheld. People in Buenos Aires were talking about Patagonia as if it were in the middle of a Bolshevik revolution, and like, it's not that far from the truth, except, you know, it's more like economic, less political, right? Still, even though the newspapers reported on it as if it were, you know, an out-and-out revolution, they would get reports that were more grounded. Here's one from La Prensa. They interviewed Colonel Varela. Colonel Varela denies that these people were insurgents, arguing that they were simply striking workers who had not committed the outrages of which they have been accused. He said that while they did requisition supplies, they also issued vouchers to the victims of these thefts so they could be reimbursed by the resistance society to which the strikers belonged. To the extent that they were armed, their arsenal was quite minimal. They were about 100 men armed with shotguns and Winchester rifles, all of which were turned over to the soldiers. After considering all aspects of the situation, the individuals were released. Later he will sing a much different tune, but that's what he said after the first wave of strikes. Now, in April, El Toscano's group attacks a ranch. Some of these workers really were bandits, right? The Worker Society distanced itself from El Toscano, and he formally became an outlaw, right? More and more independent unions were starting to form and were allowed, provided that they broke with the Worker Society. Antonio Soto was becoming increasingly isolated, and because Judge Vinas was gone, the new radical governor did not want to back the union. The union started to splinter. All the while, the landowners plotted. What was going to reignite everything? The Rural Society, representing the ranchers, chose to put on a macabre display. They ritually disinterred the bodies of the police officers who were killed, and they held a candlelit wake in the governor's mansion. They were quite literally digging up the past to provoke more conflict. Ranchers, industrialists, government officials, the upper crust of society, they all turned up to pay their respects. Almost like a blood ritual or something, right? Now, to be fair, also after this, the Worker Society, they exhumed and reburied one of their comrades in response to this morbid display. Their funeral procession was much more well attended, and at the funeral they sang the song Hijos del Pueblo. Everything was building up to a confrontation in September, which was shearing month. That's when workers and bosses all work overtime to shear their sheep and get the wool, you know, all sorted out. In the meantime, four small events occurred in quick succession, which all cranked up, you know, the tension. The first was that someone took shots at an accountant for the Patagonia Trading Company. The accountant had fired several workers. He was not hit, but it raised tensions. Second, workers forcibly disarmed the president of the Santa Cruz Patriotic League in the streets when he drew a gun and fired on some workers marching. Third, someone, presumably workers, stole some horses, the implication being that they were going to be used for upcoming strike purposes. The fourth incident occurred on July 9th, Argentine Independence Day. That was when the upper crust of society, including the Spanish Society and the Cosmopolitan Society, they held a big banquet at the Hotel Español. It was attended also by naval and army officers. Present at the banquet was one of the ranchers who was under boycott by the Worker Society. Under the leadership of the chef Antonio Perez, the workers refused to serve the table of the rancher who was being boycotted. The table also was adorned with gauche Argentine flags at every seat. They refused to serve anyone unless that rancher left. The bourgeoisie turned this into a big incident. It was just a bridge too far. God help you if you get between us and our snacks, right? Someone who was in attendance wrote an editorial in La Unión addressing the incident, and I'll quote from it. On Saturday evening, something occurred that was nothing more than yet another in a long series of similar incidents that had plagued our country. The employees at a local hotel refused to serve at a banquet on the pretext that they were boycotting one of the guests. It should have been enough for them to see that this was a patriotic gathering, attended by the authorities, for them to refrain from using their petty but annoying tool of proletarian resistance. Refrain they did not, and the slogans of the Workers' Federation, which workers will deny if asked to confess by the authorities, as has occurred on other occasions, these slogans outweighed the cordial and refined nature of the gathering. In this way, the workers are setting themselves up as a power in opposition to the established order, showing no reverence for the nation's symbols. It is nevertheless thanks to these symbols and the generous freedoms they represent that organized labor has been allowed such a wide field of action. But it was a mistake to offend patriotic sentiments. This has reminded us that whoever is not a friend of the fatherland is its enemy, and that it would be prudent to pluck out the worm and cauterize the wound in order to prevent wholesale infection. Self-defense is a just response to aggression, and self-defense has no limits when it repels an unjust aggression. A tougher line will have to be taken, argued a different editorial. Now, I want you to remember that self-defense is a just response to aggression. Arguably true. Then they say, self-defense has no limits when it repels an unjust aggression. Very questionable. And remember, not being served during a grand banquet. That is, you know, one of several of these aggressions. And we will see, you know, we'll see what their version of self-defense looks like. Now, as we've talked about, the whole foreign elements thing didn't play very well in Patagonia because no one was even Argentine-born. So instead, they went and did a big push for free labor. That was what the aforementioned Free Labor Association was all about. It's fundamentally the same concept as right to work, like the right to work laws in the US. It's designed to make it look like unions are preventing people from working, and who doesn't want the right to work, right? It should be explained that as September approached, which was, you know, shearing season, there were limited strikes, mainly in the form of boycotts against certain ranchers who did not agree to their contracts. But separate from that, there was not a total general strike yet. So we are heading towards, you know, shearing season. Still some ongoing conflicts, but for the most part, most workers were working. On August 16, 1921, President E. Grigoyen met with 40 of the top ranchers and businessmen of Patagonia, including the Braun and Menendez families. We know what they discussed, like we know what topics they were talking about. We don't know what was decided, although I think, given what ends up happening, it is fair to surmise the worst. On August 29th, these ranchers sent in scabs to certain ranches. This time they framed it as defenders of free labor, and in limited circumstances, these scabs were successful. On September 20th, strikers intimidated scabs by firing guns in the air. This time, police used it as a pretext to sack union headquarters and arrest everyone they could. Antonio Soto stepped down as Secretary General, and he tapped Antonio Perez, the aforementioned chef from the banquet incident, to head the union. Antonio Soto then traveled from ranch to ranch, personally encouraging all of the workers. Interestingly, on October 1st, President E. Grigoyen and his radical civic union, they abolished the death penalty, which becomes an extremely ironic piece of legislation. On October 8th, El Toscano was captured. He and the union had had a falling out, but it is important to remember that with 68 gone and El Toscano captured, the union members most experienced with gunplay and tactics are now out of the game. At the same time, remember, it is shearing season. That's when workers at the end of shearing season would be paid. That's when ranchers were to comply with their contracts. And if they didn't, that is when the strikes would happen. But before that point, police all across Patagonia launched a coordinated campaign to arrest union organizers. They sacked the union headquarters again, they arrested Antonio Perez, they beat him severely and put him on a Navy ship, effectively disappearing him. Though, as we will see, it ironically probably saved his life. When Antonio Soto, visiting the workers on the Braun family-owned Bella Vista Ranch, when Soto heard that Antonio Perez, the current Secretary General for the Union, had been beaten and captured, and the general repression of everyone else, Soto drafted a communique for, you guessed it, a general strike. To the people of Rio Gallegos and the workers across the country, greetings. Just when we felt at peace, secure in our work after the tragic events of the recent strike, we see the return of the barbarous reaction characteristic of that den of degenerate pimps and opportunists known as the Patriotic League, with their banner of free labor. Rural workers, let us take up this dignified, manly struggle and refuse to produce anything for these patriotic parasites. The arbitrary deportation of our comrades demands that we bring out the best within us and make sacrifices. A general strike has been declared, and its reach must be absolute, both in the countryside and in the town. Workers, be aware. This time, their only demand was for their fellow workers to be released. It should probably go without saying, of course, that Antonio Perez was arrested, you know, illegally, like he didn't actually commit any crime. Upon starting the general strike, they unfurled the red and black flag like they had done many times before. This strike, all across Patagonia, was the largest strike in Argentine history. President E. Grigoyen signed an order to send in the Army and Navy yet again. He sent Colonel Varela yet again. This time, they were sent to act on a war footing. The 10th Cavalry Regiment left for Patagonia on November 4th, 1921. By November 5th, all of southern Santa Cruz was completely paralyzed. No one was working. Antonio Soto decided to try and free their imprisoned workers in Rio Gallegos. He also sent one of his undersecretaries named Sambuchetti to meet with the governor to see about negotiating freeing the prisoners. When Sambuchetti and his small group approached the governor's mansion. The police captured and hogtied them and put them in prison. When they searched these men, the police found a red card with Cyrillic text that one of them had been carrying. I quote from Bayer's book, "There's finally proof, the great conspiracy. No one understands a word, but it's written in Russian. It can evidently only speak of revolution, death, bloodshed, anarchism, maximalism, and in the end, anti-Argentinism. This identity card is enough to prove no more and no less than that the Patagonian strike has been inspired by Moscow. It's proof enough for Argentina's newspapers and military officers to speak of a vast foreign conspiracy aimed at destroying the nation's sovereignty. Besides the identity card, they also find some extremely suspicious letters, all of them written in Russian. Though no one bothers to translate them, they evidently constitute proof of a conspiracy. A translation might have proven to be a great disappointment. The identity card was issued by the Leo Tolstoy Library in Argentina, which allowed its members to read the works of Bakunin, Kropotkin, Proudhon, Marx and Engels, and literary figures like Maxim Gorky. The letters were to his family, although they did include some news of what was happening with the strikes. These prisoners were taken to a naval vessel. Yet again, this ironically saved their lives. The police captured the entire union leadership other than Antonio Soto, but the strike continued to spread nonetheless. Most ranchers took their families and fled, all except one family, the Schroeders, a German family that owned several ranches. They refused to flee. On November 5th, the Schroeder family fired upon strikers, and they got into an extended gun battle, causing the strikers to flee. After that, the Schroeders got into their car and drove to Puerto Coil. I can't handle some of these names. Puerto Coil. Where they sent a telegraph to the police asking for assistance. Colonel Varela arrived in Patagonia on November 9th. He wrote upon arriving in Patagonia, "Work was at a complete standstill. The landowners, administrators, supervisors, and foremen were all being held captive, aside from a few who had managed to escape, leaving their property in the hands of the rebels. It had been this way for quite some time, and nothing was known of their fate. It was even claimed that many of them had been murdered, for their ranches were looted and burned to the ground. It was even claimed that many of them had been murdered, their ranches looted, then burned to the ground. In general, it can be said that the local population was in such a state of nervous excitement that it bordered on desperation. The authorities had done nothing, and the police limited themselves to reporting on events as they occurred. With communications severed, the only reliable news was that some police officers had fled, leaving behind their weapons and ammunition, which were then seized by the rebels. This could be confirmed by their later attacks. Some police officers also let themselves be taken prisoner, without putting up the least resistance." Unquote. In retrospect, of course, none of the ranchers were murdered, only a few ranches were looted, and none were burned to the ground. The strikers thought that the army would be an arbitrator like they were last time. However, Colonel Varela would exploit that belief to put down the strikes. First, Colonel Varela and his men took a small ranch with little to no resistance. Then they approached Punta Alta on November 11th, and the killings began. By the way, Argentine patriots to this day claim that Colonel Varela was fighting the Chilean army, but as you might imagine, this has like literally no bearing in reality. The 10th Cavalry set a trap for the strikers, then they fired upon the strikers. I will quote from a surviving worker. "Those left standing were taken prisoner. The wounded were given a coup de grace with either bullets or sabers, depending on the whims of their executioners. I myself had been shot in the right elbow and in the chest. Upon seeing those maddened hyenas at work, I got the happy idea of playing dead, as those panthers in the shape of men were so ferocious that neither clamors nor pleas would move them. I spent the rest of the day in a heap of corpses. When night fell and the camp went quiet, I was able to silently drag myself over to the bushes. This survivor was able to make it to a farm get first aid, and he continued saying, "The pain from my wounds, the thirst that was devouring me, and the vision of the horrible carnage I had witnessed and suffered ensured that my attempts to sleep were in vain. My head was a Dantesque scene, haunted by a thousand dreadful ghosts. And there I lay until the sound of a gunshot woke me from my trance. More and more gunshots followed. I didn't know the reason for the shooting until days later, when I came across two companions in misfortune. They told me of what I had not been able to witness myself on the day of the attack and on the days that followed. I have heard their stories, and those of other wretches like us who have managed to save themselves from the massacres elsewhere." One of the German ranchers witnessing these executions reportedly shouted in broken Spanish, "This is not how you kill people. Not even in the European war where I fought for 4 years did they ever execute unarmed prisoners." Now, this is obviously not technically true, but regardless, it shows that the level of violence even freaked out some of the ranchers, even though most ranchers were incredibly pleased. At Punta Alta, the number of dead is disputed. The Fora Union says 37. One of the 10th Cavalry says 30. 30 was reported by a local newspaper. The Chilean government reported 5. Varela's list of prisoners lists 35 names, and they only turned over a couple prisoners, the implication being that roughly that many were killed, whether in the initial shootout or executed afterwards. That is just the start, however. After this, Colonel Varela issued a decree basically abolishing unions in Patagonia, listing rules for ranch workers to abide by, and declaring war on the strikers. On November 16th, several thousand strikers rode into Paso Ibáñez. They sent over several hostages as a sign of good faith and waved the white flag, declaring their intention to negotiate an end to the strike. Instead, the Navy fired upon the strikers. The strikers held out until Colonel Varela arrived. They asked to meet with him to negotiate. The terms the strikers offered were the return of the deported and freedom for those imprisoned in connection with the social conflicts, in connection with the strikes, the departure of the so-called free laborers from Patagonia, along with strike breakers, the acceptance by the landowners of the list of demands that they had already agreed to, an agreement not to engage in reprisals against workers who have participated in strikes. Just several points to discuss. The workers knew that you needed to make several demands in order to obtain even half, right? Colonel Varela's offer was immediate, unconditional surrender, and he showed them a proclamation of execution by firing squad to everyone who doesn't surrender. Now, I probably don't need to point out that Varela's executions were illegal under Argentine law, but that he was also probably acting under President Yrigoyen's direct orders, right? The strikers released their hostages, many fled, and then Colonel Varela moved in to occupy Paso Ibáñez. Then Colonel Varela rode northward toward another group of strikers. He shot down more, and there were more executions. The numbers for each of these becomes harder and harder to calculate, because, as you might imagine, the army stopped listing how many prisoners they were taking and how many were executed for, you know, obvious reasons. The army carried out more mass executions. Possibly the biggest occurred on December 1st, where Colonel Varela pursued another group of strikers at the Bella Vista Ranch. They took 430 strikers prisoner. Here they carried out the largest number of mass executions. It's pretty well documented that they shot over 200 prisoners. Their bodies were covered with pitch and burned. There's the account of a rancher who wrote, seeing this, saying, "Almost all of them still had pieces of darkening flesh, the color of burnt offal, hanging off their otherwise clean bones. Their work boots were still on their feet. They lay on a sort of sandy crust that seemed to be made up of blood, ashes, and melted human fat." Other ranchers visited and saw the crust formed on the ground where the corpses were burnt at the Bella Vista Ranch. Another contingent working with the 10th Cavalry Regiment mopped up strikers in the northern part of Santa Cruz. There was another massacre at La Anita, and at this massacre, in reviewing the Army's list of seized weapons and prisoners, these strikers only had about one gun for every five men, which is hardly an insurgent army, right? Antonio Soto, having heard what was happening to his comrades at Punta Alta and Paso Ibanez, he argued that they should go underground, take hostages, go into the forests and into the mountains, and create a civil war, basically. Most of the strikers did not want this, but they also did not want to be massacred. We have an account of Antonio Soto arguing with his union, and I will quote it here. Soto gave the speech of his life. Shouting dramatically, he commanded everyone's attention. As he spoke, his Spanish blood came to the fore. They will shoot every single one of you. No one will be left alive. Let's flee, comrades. Let's continue with the strike until we win. Don't trust the military. They're the most despicable, treacherous, and cowardly pack of dogs on the planet. They are professional cowards, resentful because they are forced to wear uniforms and obey orders their entire lives. They don't know the meaning of work and hate free thinkers. Don't surrender, comrades, awaiting the coming dawn of social redemption, which will bring freedom for all. Don't surrender, comrades, await the coming dawn of social redemption, which will bring freedom for all. Let's fight for this dawn. Let's hide in the forest. Do not surrender. He beat his fists against his breast, shouted, and even shed a tear when no one responded. He tried to raise his men's irreparably fallen spirits, but they were resigned to their fates. Soto did not want to give up, so he gave his all in a final assembly, surrounded by the marvelous landscape of Lago Argentino. You are workers, you are laborers. See this strike through until our definitive triumph, when we will create a new society, where there are neither rich nor poor, where there are neither weapons nor uniforms nor soldiers, where there is happiness and respect for human life, and no one will have to kneel before a priest or a boss. The assembly voted in favor of unconditional surrender. A small contingent refused and left with Antonio Soto. Soto left, saying, "I am not meant to be thrown to the dogs. If my comrades are staying to fight, I will stay. But my comrades don't want to fight." Only like 12 men followed Antonio Soto, and they rode off into the Cordillera, and they eventually found their way to Chile. We will revisit Antonio Soto in the following and final episode. There were further massacres which played out in much the same way. A particularly macabre detail was that the army set up a system wherein they would hold several hundred prisoners at a time, and then they allowed the ranchers and bosses to come and pick out which workers were loyal or were able to be rehabilitated. They would survive, everyone else would die. Reportedly, those that were picked became almost obsessively loyal to their bosses for the rest of their lives. There are also stories like the following, told by a soldier in the army. On our way to some ranch, I don't remember which, we came across a 15-year-old boy who said he was looking for work. The captain let him go, but then we came across him a second time, and then a third. We discovered that he was a messenger for the strikers. He was shot alongside two other men. I remember the boy's bravery. When we took him before the firing squad, he shouted, "Murderer!" to our commander, and then he fell. One of the bullets severed his tongue. The truth is that when you're a soldier, you're not afraid of death. You don't feel a thing when you're getting ready to kill. But I deeply regretted the death of this boy. I had to hide it from my superiors, though. After all these slayings, as you might imagine, the rural society then set wages very low for Patagonia and did not face major labor troubles for a long time. Across the board, many jobs received reductions up to 50% and 30% for others, and working conditions remained very bad. On January 1st, 1922, the Rio Gallegos Rural Society held a lavish banquet for Lieutenant Colonel Varela in the Hotel Argentino. The hotel didn't have enough space for all the people who came out to celebrate the brilliant feats of the armed forces, but among those present, a frank sense of joy could be felt, where they celebrated with liquor and gourmet food, After the champagne was poured, the Royal Society president gave a toast. "My spirit has opened itself to experiencing the sweet excitement of these times, in which gratitude mingles with the satisfaction of seeing such a noble mission accomplish all of its goals in our territory. It's enough to look around this room to be certain of the high regard you have earned through your crusade of liberation. And I say liberation because anachronistic hordes hiding in the folds of the red flag have spent the year violating all the rights and freedoms secured by our heroic ancestors for the well-being of their children." All the ranchers were visibly moved as this man spoke of the debt of gratitude that they all owed Colonel Varela. "We have lived through trying times, and we have all experienced the feeling that our forces, honed for no struggle other than daily labors, have collapsed under the unprecedented attacks of a directionless, unscrupulous mob. Lieutenant Colonel Varela, you knew how to act in such a way that definitively guarantees our national sovereignty and the rule of law. Our gratitude will follow you wherever your destiny takes you, and the memory of your actions in our territory will endure in our memory as a lesson of what men can do when inspired by their patriotic duty and their love for the fatherland." The officers, ranchers, merchants, and police all got to their feet and sang the national anthem. And then, to top it off, the British suspects, who were quite numerous, sang, "For he's a jolly good fellow," in honor of Varela.
"For he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, which nobody can deny, which nobody can deny, which nobody can deny. For he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, which nobody can deny, which nobody can deny."
The soldiers, hankering for sex after so much murder, as you do, they were allowed to now visit brothels, now that their work was done. I quote from Osvaldo Bayer's book. "But when the first group of soldiers approaches the brothel, the madam rushes out and speaks with the NCO in charge. It's clear that something's going on, and the soldiers begin to get nervous. Their superior explains that something unexpected has happened. All five of the bordello's prostitutes have refused to sleep with the soldiers, and the madam insists that she cannot force them. The NCO and the conscripts take it as an insult, as an attack on the country they represent. Besides, they were also very aroused. They talk amongst themselves and spur each other on. They try to storm the doors of the brothel. But then the five girls come out, armed with brooms, and confront the soldiers with cries of 'murderers, pigs,' and 'we don't sleep with murderers.' The word 'murderers' sends a chill through the soldiers. Though they still reach for their sabers, they back away from the whores, who are swinging their brooms like women possessed. There's a terrible commotion. The soldiers give up, but remain on the sidewalk in front of the brothel. The girls in the doorway don't hold their tongues. Aside from murderers and pigs, they call them sons of bitches, and, according to a later police report, other obscene insults as could be expected from such sluts," quoting from the police report. "But there's nothing that can be done. Being called murderers is enough for these seasoned soldiers to forget all about women. Their itching between their legs turns into a bitter taste in their mouths, and the only desire they have left is to drown their rage in drink. Patient research has allowed us to discover the names of these five whores, these five women who were the only ones brave enough to publicly say that the perpetrators of the bloodiest massacre of workers in our history were nothing more than murderers. Their names are reproduced here as a small tribute to the memory of these five women who closed their legs as a gesture of rebellion. Here are their names as they appeared on the yellowing pages of the police report. Consuelo Garcia, 29 years old, Argentine, single, prostitute at La Catalana brothel. Angelina Fortunato, 31 years old, Argentine, married, seamstress and prostitute. Amalia Rodriguez, 26 years old, Argentine, single, prostitute. Maria Juliaque, Spaniard, 28 years old, resident of Argentina for the past 7 years, prostitute. Maud Foster, English woman, 31 years old, single, resident of Argentina for the past 10 years, a woman from a good family, prostitute. No flower has ever been placed on the mass graves of the strikers, which have only ever been graced by stone, mata negra, and the eternal Patagonian wind. The only flower we have managed to find is the brave gesture of the prostitutes of La Catalana brothel on February 17th, 1922. Now, I've seen the death tolls for the abortive Patagonian revolution listed as low as 300 and as high as 1500. Like, that is what you would see on Wikipedia, for example. The great wisdom of our day usually says it's fair to just split the difference and assume the truth's somewhere in the middle, like, I don't know, 600 or something. But, as we've seen, there were several massacres, each of which approached the low end of the estimate. A truly rigorous counting of the dead show there to be far closer to the high end of the number, 1500. Wikipedia also states that many of the slain were Chileans, which is not true. Next week, we will have one more episode covering some of the repercussions and fallout of the massacres in Patagonia. What can we learn from today? For one thing, we can see how the same forces which massacred the Indians of Argentina massacred the workers too. It's the same forces of greed and exploitation who will kill to assert their dominance over the land and its inhabitants. We saw how the populist progressive President Irigoyen arranged for the repressive forces of the state to solve this problem, and then lacked the courage to own up to the crime. This is just like, I don't know, you could say like Obama doing drone strikes or Trudeau pushing oil pipelines or something, right? We saw how the forces of reaction reacted. They reorganized to be stronger, well-equipped, and ready to face the strikes. They did not mess around when the time came. Still, when the time came, it was not the ranchers or the bourgeoisie doing the killing. It was the army, the soldiers. Along the same lines, the military arbitrated the first wave of strikes and killed workers in the second. That's another lesson. Things don't always play out the same way with these strikes, right? The way the Argentine army handled these massacres was a vision for the 20th century to come in Central and South America. What with civil wars, death squads, Operation Condor, the Desaparecidos, the whole lot. All of this was happening in 1921 and 1922. We saw how Colonel Varela was celebrated by the ranchers and by British capital. He will get a much cooler reception when he returns to Buenos Aires, and we will go into it. But initially, the first to condemn the massacres were the brave prostitutes of Patagonia, in a scene right out of some Greek tragedy. When I decided to cover these events, I wanted to depict heroes, not just massacres and crimes. Unfortunately, they seem to go hand in hand. Maybe next week, we'll have more fun. I don't know. For sources today, I used the book Rebellion in Patagonia by Osvaldo Bayer. Can't recommend it enough. That's the main one. And of course, there's his other books, which I used to a lesser extent, Simone Radowitzky and the People's Justice and the Anarchist Expropriators. To a much lesser degree, there's also the graphic novel Prisoner 155 about Simone Radowitzky. Can't recommend these books enough, and I hope to do one more episode, at least. Thank you for listening, dear listener. You are already on the premium side, so just let people know about the show. See you next week, and God bless.
Cigarro y las malas señoras, saltar paredes y abrir las ventanas, y cuando lloro una mujer, me gusta el vino tanto como las flores y los conejos, pero no los tractores, y el pan casero y la voz de Dolores, y el mar mojándome los pies. No soy de aquí ni soy de allá, no tengo edad ni por venir, y ser feliz es mi color de identidad. Me gusta estar tirado siempre en la arena, o en mi matungo perseguir a Manuela, o todo el tiempo para ver las estrellas con la María en el trigal. No soy de aquí ni soy de allá, no tengo edad ni por venir, y ser feliz es mi color de identidad. El sol, Alicia y las palomas, el buen cigarro y las malas señoras, saltar paredes y abrir las ventanas, y cuando llora una mujer.